Hi guys, my name's Haley. I'm an addict.
Hey,
I'm really nervous. This is an honor and a privilege to speak at a retreat, especially a retreat that I love so much. Whenever I was asked to speak, I told somebody that I was asked, and she was like, "Oh, that's a perfect topic for you to speak on." And I got like super offended, like, "What are you saying? I relapse a whole bunch? Like, I don't understand." But no, I have experience, you know. Definitely. I'm so nervous. I'm sorry. So I don't know. Like, I found the rooms whenever I was 18. And I came on accident. I didn't know that I was going to an NA meeting. I was just going as for support for one of my friends. And, people were like saying, "Hi, you know, my name's Haley, I'm an addict." Everybody would say hi back, and I'd start laughing because I thought that was only in the movies. I didn't think this stuff happened in real life. I didn't know there was like really meetings. And I don't know, like, I just remember going to that first meeting, and even though I was an addict at that time, I thought, I still felt at home. Like, everybody came up and hugged me. They saw right through me, you know. They knew that this is exactly where I needed to be. And they told me, "Welcome home." And, you know, I just always knew that this is where I wanted to be from that first meeting. And, you know, like, I went a couple of times, and, you know, I couldn't get my stuff together. I didn't get a home group. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work steps. I didn't do any of that stuff because I didn't know that I needed to, you know. And finally, I went to my first rehab and admitted that I was an addict, and I went for real. And, you know, like, I was in rehab, so I was homeless, and I figured they offered, like, this halfway house, and I was like, "Oh, I never done that. Like, I can't go home, so I might as well go to the halfway house." And I went out there, and I stayed, and then I got into this relationship, which was, you know, obviously not suggested. And it worked out real well. I stayed clean for, like, 3 months in the halfway house, but, like, I kept getting in trouble because I was in this relationship I wasn't allowed to be in. So I left, and I went to a three-quarter house, and everybody told me I was going to get high. I was like, no, you wait, you watch. I'm not going to. And, like, another 3 months went by, and then I got high. And, you know, like, I didn't listen to anything anybody had to say because I just thought that I knew everything. And, you know, I'll never forget, like, I had this relapse party after that, you know. Like, I came home to Greensburg to some of my friends, and, you know, like, I told them, like, "We're going to have a party. We're going to party it up because now I can. Like, I'm not involved in this program. Like, we might as well, you know." And it was crazy. I went to, the party started at this motel that I, like, first shot dope in for the first time. So it, like, brought everything back. And I was like, "Oh, no, this is not a good sign already." And we got kicked out of there. And then we went back to my friend's house. And this was, like, my party, right? My party. And everybody was having so much fun at my party except for me because I was stuck in the bathroom. Like, I could not get out of the bathroom, and that's, like, how quickly it progressed for me, you know. And so I went back to rehab, and, you know, whenever I got out, like, I convinced my mom it was a good idea for me to move home, and I truly thought that it was, you know, like, if I just had to, like, work this program. And I got a sponsor who I still have today that I love dearly. And we went to meetings, like, all the time. I went to meetings like it was my job. And then I got a job, and I went to school full-time, and then I started working full-time, and I got all these responsibilities. Like, it was suggested that, like, I take things slow, you know what I mean? But, like, I just jumped headfirst into things. Like, I didn't, after that point, like, I just wanted to grow up, and I just kept thinking about where my life was and where I should be at that time. Like, all my friends were in college, and, like, that's where I needed to be. And, you know, I went to college, and I did well until, you know, I couldn't leave my car in the parking lot because I had to get high, you know. And I had to go back to rehab, thank God. And, you know, what's crazy about that last time was, I was working a program. I was working steps. I was involved in service. I was, like, taking, like, I was going to H&I. I was speaking for people on an H&I level, and I was just doing all of this stuff. I thought I was super involved, right? But I got high, and I didn't tell anybody. And I hid it for the longest time, and I thought since I got away with that time, like, I could get away with it again. And I kept doing that. And eventually, like, I was just that person that was high in the meetings. And because, like I said, like, this is where I wanted to be. Like, I wanted to be in Narcotics Anonymous so bad. It was just, like, after I put that first one in me, like, I couldn't stop putting it in me, you know? And I didn't want to get honest. I didn't want to humble myself and, like, say that, like, I messed up and, like, I need help because I was so involved. Like, I was working these steps. I was doing all of this stuff. And, you know, the one night I picked my friend up. He just got out of rehab. And we were, like, getting ready to go cop. And this car that I wanted so bad so soon, you know, like, we were driving it. And I don't know what happened, but I smashed into the back of somebody's car and, like, completely totaled my car. Like, the airbags deployed. I thought I was dead. All I saw was white. And his head went through the windshield. It was crazy. And whenever the airbags went down and I realized I wasn't dead, I was, like, really upset. Because then I had to explain to my mom what happened. And I had to get honest. And that sucked. And I called my mom, you know, to come pick me up from the scene of this car accident. And, you know, this cop came. And, of course, like, this is the same cop that's dealt with this kid so many times. So they know exactly what he's about. And here I am, like, he pulls me aside and he's like, you know what, like, I know what this kid is about. Like, I don't know if, like, you're doing that. And I'm like, oh, no, like, we just came from an AA meeting. I'm showing him my key tags and stuff. And he doesn't believe me for one second. Like, he knows. And he asked me to see my arms. And I was like, I didn't know, like, you know, cops were allowed to do that. But apparently they are. And I showed him. And, of course, like, on this specific day, my arms are, like, the worst they've ever looked my entire using career. And he was like, well, that doesn't look like you have 9 months clean. And I was like, oh, well, they're just scars. They're old. And he's like, okay. And he didn't do anything. He didn't say anything to me. When my mom came, he pulled her aside and, like, told her what he saw. And my mom didn't say anything. And that's when I knew, like, I was caught. Like, I was in trouble. And we went to the hospital. And I'm, like, trying to hide it, trying to evade, you know, the subject. Like, just trying to pretend like nothing happened. And, you know, she saw my arms and, like, she took my phone and called everybody with .NA after it. It was crazy. She didn't know what to do, you know. And she got a hold of my sponsor and I talked to her and, like, she just explained to me, like, this is life and death, you know. Like, you could have died. Like, what are you trying to do? Like, are you trying to live or are you trying to die today? And this is serious, you know. And we cried on the phone and stuff. And I think I went to rehab. Yeah, I went to rehab again. Man. And that time, like, I was done. Like, I was done. I was ready. And I felt so much pain from, like, all that lying and hiding and cheating and manipulation and, like, all that stuff, you know. Like, I just didn't want to do it anymore. I wanted no parts of it. So, you know, I had a blast in rehab, of course, and I got out, and I went to this three-quarter house because I didn't want to go to a halfway house because I wanted my cell phone, and somebody called me on my cell phone, and I got high. And, like, it's just, like, little, tiny, simple suggestions that I was not willing to take. Just the smallest ones. Like, maybe you shouldn't have a cell phone for a couple of months. Like, not a big deal. Everybody around you has a cell phone. Why do you need one? You know, like, I needed my phone. And that phone that I needed so bad, like, was, you know, my demise. And so I got kicked out of there, and I did some ripping and running in Pittsburgh, and it was just, it was bad. It was really bad. And I ended up getting arrested. And that was, I thought I was, like, above jail. I thought that, you know, nobody's going to arrest me. I'm not the type that goes to jail. And then I was in jail. And that was scary, you know. And once I got out, like, I was done. Never going back there. Never going back. It's not my thing. Like, I'm not the jail type. Like, it's somebody else can do it. And, you know, I went to this three-quarter house. My really good friend got me in. He was running it down in McKees Rocks. And he got me in for, like, next to nothing because I had no money. I had no nothing. Like, and I got out right, I think it was the 23rd of December, 2011. And I called my mom, and she came and picked me up in the South Side. And I went and spent Christmas with her and my sponsor and, like, a couple of people in recovery. And, like, I loved it. Loved every second of it. And I was so scared of everything. I was so scared. And that's when I went to this three-quarter house, you know. And in this three-quarter house, like, it was crazy. Like, everybody in there was getting high, and I was trying to tell on them. And, like, nobody was listening to me. And, like, you can't just leave this three-quarter house without somebody coming with you. And the people that would have come with me were the ones that were getting high. So, like, I was stuck. I was completely stuck. And, you know, eventually, like, I got high with them. And it was awful, man. I went the next day and I told on myself. I went to the office and I told on myself. And I told this kid, Nick, I was like, listen, I was crying. Like, if I don't stop, like, I'm just going to die. Like, how much have I been through? Like, how many times have I relapsed and, like, I still can't get my shit together? Like, what's wrong with me? Like, why can't I do this? And I just knew, if I got high again, I was going to die, whether it was from an overdose or just killing myself because I had to, like, go through all that pain again. And he just sat there and, like, he held me and he said, it's okay, just remember how you feel right now. Just remember this feeling. And I do. I remember, I'll never forget that feeling. And thank God I haven't gotten high since then. That was January 2nd, 2012. And, you know, what's crazy is, like, eventually I left that three-quarter house. I maybe had 60 days clean. Maybe. And I went to Greensburg. And, you know, this kid that got me into the three-quarter house that, like, told me, you know, not to forget that feeling. Like, he was still there. He was running the house and stuff. And, like, that day, like, I went back and I got a phone call the night before that he relapsed and he died. And that sucks so bad. Like, this stuff's so real. And, like, it sometimes, like, it doesn't hit me, like, how real, like, the disease is until, like, somebody so close to me dies like that, you know? Like, so unexpected. Like, he was running a three-quarter house. He was working a program. Like, he was clean. And then all of a sudden, he's dead. That's crazy. And that could have been me, you know? And, you know, like, that moment right there, like, 60 days clean, like, that's whenever I decided, like, I need to buck up. Like, I need to do something. I need to really take this stuff seriously. And I did. Like, I was really in contact with my sponsor. I called her every day. Like, we went to meetings all the time. And I went to meetings just, like, multiple times a day. Like, and at that time in my life, I was in the position where I didn't have to work. So I didn't have a job. I didn't have a cell phone for, like, 6 months. Like, it was awesome, you know? Like, I didn't have anything. And I just really dove feet first into this program, and I did what was suggested to me. And because of, like, all the other times that I'd been in the program, you know, like, people, you know, like, I knew people. So I already had, like, a we in Greensburg, and I just, like, kept in contact with them. And, you know, now today, like, it says, like, in the basic text, like, I was reading this chapter. I love it so much. It said, you know, something about, like, now, like, complacency is the enemy of people with substantial clean time. I don't think that I have, like, substantial clean time, but I have clean time. Like, I have more than 60 days now, you know? And that's, like, really been my story lately, where it's, like, I've been getting, like, real short with people. My tolerance level's been real low, and I've just been going to meetings because that's been my habit for the past, like, almost 3 years. It's just go to a meeting every day, you know? And you know, like, I'm involved with service. Thank God I'm involved with service. I'm super involved because my sponsor made me go to, like, area service before I was even clean and stamp pamphlets. And she told me that every pamphlet I stamped, it was another second clean. So I sat there and I stamped a whole bunch of pamphlets. I wanted to stay clean. And, you know, now I'm the literature chair, you know, like she passed that down to me, and like I'm the treasurer of my home group, and like that's kind of kept me going to meetings and like kept me in the middle and kept me involved whenever I really don't want to be sometimes, you know, like my life is so different. Like I'm pregnant, I'm having a baby, I have a job, I have a house, I have a really nice car now. And like all of this stuff is happening, and like to anybody, any Joe Schmo that passes me on the street, they don't think like I'm a heroin addict. They don't think that I'm a junkie or I'm in recovery or anything. They just think like I'm a normal person. And that's crazy to me. It blows my mind. And that's because of this program, you know? And I don't forget that. I don't forget that I got that from NA, like, whatsoever. It's just lately, like, where I've been, you know, like, I've been sitting on my step work for, like, an embarrassingly long amount of time, and that's, like, what it is, you know? And thank God my sponsor and I are going to go over it today. And, you know, like, I know that I'll feel better after that. And always after spiritual retreats, I feel better. But, you know, like it says in the basic text, too, like, we just need to do, like, we need to get back to the basics, like, as soon as we can. Like, as soon as we identify the problem, like, we need to, like, call our sponsor again. Like, we need to do, like, go to meetings. Like, if you have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days again, like, do it. You know, like, we just have to get involved and, that's, like, what I'm doing right now is that I almost feel like a newcomer again because I'm going back to, like, all these basics because I'm scared to relapse, man, especially now that I have so much on the line. Like, I just don't want it to happen. And I don't know. Like, it's really simple. Like, this is the most simple program, and it's a beautiful thing. Like, I wouldn't have my beautiful life without this beautiful program, you know? And I don't know. I'm, like, super grateful to be here. I'm really glad that I got to share on this topic. Obviously, like, I was somewhere I didn't even realize I was. But, I don't know. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Haley, for sharing. I would like to introduce the second speaker, Scott M. from Recovery Sunday, Group of NA in the South Hills area of NA.
I'm an addict. My name is Scott. I like to mirror a lot of the things. I mean, it's kind of crazy. I know Haley through some mutual friends, and our stories are very parallel. But the first thing I want to do is thank the Laurel Mountain Highlands area for asking me to speak here. When I got the Facebook message asking me, my first initial reaction was no. You know, I found like 100 different reasons why not, but I've been taught to ask my sponsor for guidance on big things. So I sent him a message and didn't hear back. So I was like, you know, I'm like 3 minutes later, I'm like, well, I just have to tell this girl, no, I can't do it. And, you know, I'm in the middle of typing a message on my phone and my phone rings and it's my sponsor. And, he said, hey man, I just got your message. Like, what's the issue? And I said, what do you mean? He said, how is that even a question? Like, you know, we've been working together for a while. Why would you say no? And I didn't have an answer for him. And, you know, I'll get real honest real quick. I've been getting disconnected with my sponsor. And he's an amazing man. And he told me, he's like, Scotty, we got to get back to the basics, man. Let's go back to step one. Let's go back to the beginning here. Like, has Narcotics Anonymous ever said no to you? And, you know, it was a truly humbling thing for me because the answer to that is absolutely not. I'll qualify real quick the way I was taught to qualify. I used too much too often for too long. I don't identify myself as any particular type of addict because I'm a trash can. I never turned down a drug unless I misunderstood the question. It didn't matter what it was for me, like, the reasons I use changed so much over the years. It started out with acceptance. Like, I wanted to be accepted by a group because I'm an addict. I suffer from low self-esteem, low self-worth, low self-value. So it was partly acceptance is how it started for me. But at some point, and I don't know where the switch flipped, but, you know, when I started putting chemicals in my body, it was for acceptance, and then I experimented with a lot of different things, and for a long time, I used because of the feeling that it provided me. a feeling of euphoria, a feeling of escape. Acceptance is one of them. It allowed me to shed my inhibitions. But at some point, after a series of some tragic events that go on in my life, throughout the course of my story, my reason for using went from how the drugs made me feel to the fact that they allowed me to not feel. And I stayed numb for a long time. And this area is real special to me. This is where I grew up. I'm from outside of Johnstown. And my first non-treatment center message of Narcotics Anonymous was provided in the Johnstown area, in the Laurel Mountain Highlands area. And couldn't stay clean there, but that was for a lot of different reasons. But I grew up pretty standard for that area. We were probably, if you had to label it, probably lower or middle class. I don't really know. Looking back on my life as a child, I didn't have barely any gratitude at all for what my parents did and what they sacrificed so I could have what I had. I just looked at the things I didn't have. So looking back on it now, I have a little more clarity that I wouldn't say we were poor, but we definitely weren't wealthy. And the reason I say that is because part of my story is like being ashamed of my family. And little things like that kind of really hit home for me. Like, they're heavy on my heart because my family was never ashamed of me. Of course, they weren't happy with the things that I did in my life, but they never turned their back on me. And family to me is not only my blood relatives, but it's the people I've met in this process. But anyway, I used for quite a long time, and my first introduction to Narcotics Anonymous was in a treatment center in Florida. The way I do things is I back myself into a corner until I only have one option. My only option at this point was to go to treatment. After, you know, moving, I've lived in different countries, I've lived in different states, I've lived all over, I've been married, I've had to bury best friends, I've had to bury my wife. A lot of these things happen, and my story comes full circle back to my parents' basement, me shooting dope on my parents' basement couch, and trying to detox myself with NyQuil and weed. And somehow that didn't work, you know, big surprise. You know, it sounded good in my head, but that's kind of the same thing, like what I think is pretty messed up. So, you know, my only option, you know, my dad's a physically large man. I've only ever seen him before my process. I've only ever seen him cry twice, and it was at his parents' funerals. And he came down into his basement. Now, this is after I've emptied all the jewelry out of their house. My mom sleeps with her purse. My dad, you know, changes his debit card number probably once a week. You know, like victimizing my family. You know, I can hear him coming down the steps. I try to act like I'm asleep. He knows better. I mean, I didn't sleep when I was detoxing. He sat down next to me. He started to tear up. And he said, "Son, what can I do to help you?" And I didn't know, you know. So he opens a book, opens the yellow pages, and calls the first number he sees. It's the first time I ever did a phone assessment, and it's pretty embarrassing doing that in front of my father. Like, when was the first time you used this? And I swear to God, it was like a 3-hour conversation. Like, how much did you use? How often? Blah blah blah. And my dad's sitting there listening to all this, and like the guilt and shame was overwhelming for me. But anyway, I get through this whole assessment, and the guy's like, "Okay, we got a bed for you. You got to get on a flight. You got to get on a plane tomorrow." I was like, "Whoa, hold on. You know, what do you mean get on a plane?" He's like, "Well, we're in Florida." And by this time, I was already committed. Like, you know, my dad's already set in his head, this is where you have to go. And I wasn't responsible enough to have insurance. So this is like around this time, actually, about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, around this time, because it was late August, I get on a plane from Pittsburgh. I, like, drag myself into this seat. I'm absolutely feeling horrible. detoxing on a plane. All these kids are like amped because they're going to Orlando, to Disney World. They're like kicking my seat, and you know, I'm running back and forth to the bathroom. Absolutely horrible experience. And then I get to this treatment facility down there, and you know, we go through all the admission stuff, and we go in, and I'm just waiting like to get my detox meds. That was like almost as exciting as copping for me, because I knew like there was this relief coming. And I go into the nurse's station, and they look over my chart, and she slides over this little Dixie cup full of, there were two Darvocet in there. I kind of looked at it, and a lot of my story is about pills. And I was like, I think you have the wrong chart. I mean, I've been shooting dope for about 15 years. And she said, no, that's how you'll detox. She gave me two Darvocet. Some things to, some Bentyl and some other stuff to help my stomach, and a trash can. I was like, here you go, grind it out. So needless to say, about 4 days later, when I could walk and get more than 20 feet from the bathroom, I started to really try and like plan my escape. My parents were paying out of pocket for this, and the reason I go into so much detail on this is this is like the story of the first five of the six times I went to treatment. And, you know, before I'm even like starting to feel better, I'm planning my escape. So anyway, I made it 10 days in there before I convinced my father that he's wasting his money. You know, I could get more individualized treatment back here, blah, blah, blah. When in reality, I just knew how and where to get high back here, and didn't know that in Florida. And, you know, so I flew back, and by the time I hit the airport in Pittsburgh, I'm text messaging people. And the deal with me was, at that point, I didn't even want to get clean. I just didn't want to have to grow up. At 30 years old, I didn't want to have to drag myself off my parents' couch. Life was easy. As far as that goes, I had a roof over my head. I had food whenever I could keep it down. And I had people to victimize, you know, because my family, they don't have the same disease I have. They don't understand that sometimes with 10 days clean, I'm crazier than I am when I'm using, because the obsession and compulsion just overwhelms me. You know, when I'm using, I'm numb. When I first get clean, like, especially when I didn't want to be clean, I'm always planning and plotting in my head, like allowing people to get close to me so I can hurt you. But you could probably tag me as a chronic relapser if you had to put a tag on it. I could argue that for the fact that I don't think I ever relapsed, because I never actually had much recovery. I'd go to treatment, come back, and do like a dirty 30 or a suspect 60 days, until my parents got off my back and I had stolen $8 here and $4 there and $20 there, and enough to actually like amount to something to go get high and find a needle and steal needles off my diabetic grandmother, and, you know, victimize enough people where I could really do some damage. At the end of my road a few years ago, I didn't want to live, but I was too afraid to die. I had some experience in these programs. Like, I read the literature. I used to get high before the meeting and walk in with my basic text like that was okay. Like that was going to like validate me to everybody that now he is just tired. That's not just what he's telling you. You know, and there's a lot of people here at this retreat that really never gave up on me, and it's a beautiful thing, man. It's amazing, and I struggle with that part of my program sometimes. Like, I really want people to understand the blessings of this program. And, you know, I was told, very similar to the guy who spoke last night, being in treatment and going back to the same facilities over and over, there's a few times, I think two or three times, where they've asked me to write a list of everything I want my first year clean. And the last time they did it, I almost got kicked out of treatment because I refused to do it. And the counselor that I had argued with me over it. And finally, when I got to voice my opinion one-on-one to her, I explained to her that I've never had a year clean, so I have no idea what the possibilities are. My wildest dreams at that point were more like a rap video than anything, which is not realistic for a white kid from Monday's Corner, if you know where that is. I had this warped sense of perception, and today what I realize is that, like, what this program has provided me is some dignity, some honor, the ability to get up at 4:45 in the morning and go to work 6 days a week and work 60, 70 hours a week, be dependable. That's what that's called. I didn't know that before. I have money in my bank. I have a company credit card. I have these things that Narcotics Anonymous and the people here instilled in me that they never would have been anywhere on that list. I promise you that. Like, everything was material. Everything was about me. It was about self-centered. It was not how I could impact somebody else. They say total self-centeredness is the core of my disease, and that's still true today. Like, I don't think that ever goes away for me, but the things, everything shifts. But anyway, I did the treatment thing. Like, I went to this cushy rehab in Florida twice. I like to go back to rehabs because I know what to expect, and I know which rules I can bend and which ones I can break, and I'm like the model client there, like senior client, president of the rehab, because I want to do everything I need to get the hell out of there as quick as I can. And that was the story for my first five times in treatment. I went to this place in Florida that where you you can go to the beach, you get massages, there's a chiropractor that comes in, and not quite the same as the guy who, claims I was never cured. Obviously, like that asshole says, but it didn't provide me with a struggle, man. It was a soft place to land for me, and that's not what I needed. Like, I need to be hit with reality pretty hard, because if there's any other way to do something, I'll do it. It's the path of least resistance for me, because change is hard. It's very hard for me. And I do this thing with the guys that I work with. I do a lot of training classes, and real quick, we do this thing where I'll pick two people out of the audience, have them stand next, like kind of stand face to face, about a foot away from each other. They look each other over. I make them turn around, back to back, and they change three things. Like, he would take his watch off, take his glasses off, and unbutton his shirt or something. And then they turn back around, they look at each other, and they have to identify the changes within each other. And the whole point of this exercise is, after you tell them to go ahead and sit back down, the first thing they do is change those three things immediately back. They put their watch on, put their glasses back on, and button their shirt. And the only way to change is to make it permanent. And I never did that before. Like, I'd go into treatment and everything would be temporary. I'll do whatever you want. I'll go in the evenings and read some literature so I can, like, spit some lingo at you to make you think, like, this is actually in my heart, when it's only ever actually in my head at that point. And anyway, long story short, I bounced in and out of treatment facilities that way, every time going back and forth into my parents' basement and getting worse and worse, to a point where even the Salvation Army wouldn't accept me because I couldn't get enough time strung together to pass a drug test. And again, my father came down with tears in his eyes and said, "Son, I don't know what you're going to do, but you can't stay here. You've got 3 days to figure this out." I went through Cambria County, got a placement in a treatment facility, and through the gift of desperation, I've been clean ever since. And I made all these big plans, and again, like, the thing about Narcotics Anonymous was, even though I chose not to water it, people planted seeds for years with me in my brain and said things that stuck. And a lot of those people are here today, even the fact of just, like, showing up and, the guilt and shame was overwhelming, but there was something about seeing people in these meetings, like, smiling, laughing, hugging each other, which is real foreign to me, at the end of my road. And I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a coffee because I don't drink coffee. And then I tried the coffee and I was like, no, that sucks. That's not it. Now, sticking around and, like, getting close to those people, I understand that it's step work. It's the program. What I was seeing before was the fellowship, and the fellowship is great. Don't get me wrong. It's an amazing thing. And from being plugged in with the people I've met along my journey, I know people across the country, and fellowshipping is great. But the program, the steps and traditions are the meat of this. Sponsorship, obviously, is the heartbeat of it. And my sponsor is the one who teaches me about steps and traditions, because the program will live on without the fellowship. The fellowship will not live on without the program, because we are addicts. Like, we still clean, victimize each other. We do shitty things to each other. But as long as you're in the program, you're active in the program, you'll come around to that ninth step. And eventually you'll stop doing those shitty things. I hope, or at least minimize it. But the biggest thing, man, is like, I have a higher power today, which I choose to call God. And my understanding of God today is so vast. Like, when I came into the program, my understanding of God was like this. Now it's blown out. And that's a beautiful thing to me, because, it's an interpretation. It's what I want it to be. It's what I need it to be. And, I used to look at the steps as like optional. I'd look at 12 of them instead of being like, okay, I got to work through these methodically. I'd be like, all right, I'm going to 1, 9, and 12. Okay, I'm a drug addict. I'm sorry. Let me help somebody. Those are like the three I can do. That sounds pretty decent. Like, 3 out of 12 is average. You know, I'm okay with being average. People in my life now, I understand, like, I went through this treatment facility. I went into Pittsburgh. I went to a three-quarter house. I had all these plans to go into a halfway house. And they say, if you want to hear God laugh, go ahead and make plans. I made all these plans. Like, I'm controlling this situation. This is where I'm going to go. I'm going to go into this halfway house. I don't care if they have a waiting list. What, I'm going to make this happen. And 4 days before my discharge date, I was told my medical assistance was denied. This is 3 days before Thanksgiving, so I either have to be discharged a day early or a day late. Can't be discharged on Thanksgiving because nobody's going to be in the facility, in the treatment facility, process my paperwork and get all my stuff. So immediately I call my parents because I'm not responsible. I don't have any money. I have all these plans, but I have no action behind them. And, luckily enough, through staying plugged in with the people in this facility and like talking to people and having like late night rap sessions with these guys, I was given a list of three-quarter houses in Pittsburgh. And for some reason, this one guy, I'd never been to a meeting in Pittsburgh. I very rarely went there to cop drugs, so I really knew nothing about the recovery scene, really much about Pittsburgh at all. But for some reason, and I understand now this is my higher power working in my life, this particular guy who was about three quarters of the way down the page was the first one I called, and was the only one I called. I told him, I was like, Anthony, I've got no money. You've never met me. I've got no money. I've got no ride, and I need a bed. I don't want to die, and I don't know what to do. And, thank God, he said, come on. He said, we'll take care of it. And, I talked to my parents and said, look, I need a ride to Pittsburgh. They won't discharge me on Thanksgiving. And I want to, I want to leave the day before. My parents, these plans. I want to leave the day before. I'm going to spend Thanksgiving at home. And then I'll go to Pittsburgh the next day. And my dad said, no, you're not coming home. You got to go somewhere that's safe for you. And I understand, like, I was pissed when he said that. Like, what do you mean I can't come home? I'm clean. And now I understand, like, it takes more than that. It takes more than stringing about 3 weeks together in a facility where I really didn't have the option to use. I've gotten high in treatment facilities before. I'm not proud of that. But this particular time, like, they put me in the middle of the woods, nowhere, out in the middle of nowhere. Thank God for it. But anyway, I go to Pittsburgh. I'm in a house with one of the guys from the treatment facility. Actually kind of followed me there. Good kid, and we were close for a while, but I hadn't talked to him in years. And last time I talked to him, he was in bad shape. But I went into this facility. I went into this three-quarter house. I didn't really know anybody. I'd never been to meetings. But what I had was the gift of desperation. Like, I didn't know what else to do. I needed somebody to guide me. And I started going to meetings in the South Hills. And I liked it because these meetings were big enough I could hide. I didn't want to share. I didn't know what to share. I had bounced between fellowships before. I had broken traditions in meetings. I mean, I was a mess. And everything in my being that wanted to just like pour my soul out to the first person who hugged me, something in my head told me just shut up and listen. And that's what I did. Like, I started going to meetings, and the third meeting I went to is now my home group, and has been my home group for a while. I love it. I've traveled an hour and a half, 2 hours when I was on house arrest just to get there. This meeting is absolutely essential to my recovery, because if my meeting attendance slips, but if I don't make it to any other meeting, I make it to this meeting and I have a 5-minute conversation with Robin. And, you know, I have these different people that I just kind of bounce around to, and it's the same thing every Sunday. Like, and I need that. I need to see that these people with multiple years, multiple decades, you know, 20 years clean, 10 years clean, 5 years clean, 20 minutes clean. I need to see that they're coming to this meeting, and for the people with substantial time, that it still makes sense. Because the first, I want to say, somewhere between 6 and 8 months of my recovery, I ran on straight false pride and ego. I got linked in through getting with the hip-slicking cool people in the South Hills. And there's some amazing people there. I don't mean that. But I got linked in with these people who, it promoted that false pride and ego in my life. And only through working steps do I understand how dysfunctional that is. For somebody like me, if it works for them, that's fine. It's not for me. What keeps you clean might get me high, and what keeps me clean might get you high. You know, my program is individual to me, and it's guided by my sponsor and my support group. But, you know, I went through a lot of pain those first 6 to 9 months, like an internal, because I'm still not good at externalizing or verbalizing my pain. Like, they talk about the triangle of self-obsession. I act mostly out of fear. I'm not an angry person in general, but fear guides most of my decisions, and that's anywhere in that triangle is a shitty place to be. But through this particular group of people I got linked up with, I met the gentleman who is my sponsor today, and my sponsorship family, who has some amazing people in it, and probably 80% of my support group is there. I try to stick with the men, but there are some amazing women in my life that I have not slept with, imagine that, and that they support me, and it's pretty awesome, man. Like, I can get that messed up, but I have an issue with that. Like, it's the ego again. It creeps in. Like, anybody that's friendly with me, I'm getting a little better at this, but people that are friendly with me, females especially, like, if they smile and hug me, like, that's it. You know, we've already got the two and a half kids, a white picket fence, you know, and should be looking for a divorce lawyer probably. I got a lot of issues, man, trust me. But through this program, like, there's a pretty good solution. And, you know, for me, the solution is step work. Bettering myself, like, the steps, and this is what I've been taught, the steps teach me how to live with myself, and the traditions teach me how to live with you and stay out of jail. That's a beautiful thing, because I'm not cut out for jail. I've been to jail for, like, 12 hours in Florida, and I was like, I don't ever want to go back there, anywhere. I'm not some, like, tough guy that you know, I've never been in a fight in my life. The hardest I've ever been punched is by an ex-girlfriend, and I deserved it. Just not part of my story, man. Like, the anger part of it isn't something, like, most of my anger is internalized. You know, but there's people out there, man, that are willing to help you without ever really knowing you. When you identify, when I've identified myself as an addict, it's all encompassing, and they understand that. Like, I don't have to tell them I'm a street level junkie, alcoholic, cross addicted nut job. I don't know how to say it. You know, I don't have to say all that. All I have to say is that I'm an addict, and they understand. And, you know, sponsorship, man, I can't talk enough about it, because the days I get crossed up, like, my sponsor offers me a spiritual solution to what is quite typically an unspiritual situation I put myself in. And the program has provided so much for me. Before, when I was bouncing in and out of the rooms or just going to, like, help people, I was that guy, like, and I was actually told this once, like, dude, you're loitering with the hope to recover. Like, that, it takes more than that. Like, I'd sit next to, in between Matt and Don, and hope to suck up, you know, some of that 20-some years that they have collectively. And the beautiful thing is, like, if I reach out to those people, they're willing to help me, but it's just not like osmosis. It doesn't happen that way. You know, my sponsor tells me things like, when I get myself into situations with females and I get rejected and I feel low self-worth, I feel all those things rush back in. He tells me things like, rejection is God's protection. And stuff like that's powerful for me. And he tells me things like, and he tells me this to keep me moving forward too. I understand where he's coming from, but he says, Scott, there's a girl out there for you. She's just waiting for you to get a little better. Now, he's told me that for like a year and a half. So, I guess I need to get better quicker. I'm also very stagnant on my step work at the moment. And that's where a lot of pain comes in my life. Like, there's there's some situations I put myself in that I haven't used over, thank God, but it leaves me feeling like a pretty big scumbag sometimes. And I'm not proud of that. I'm just telling you that this isn't a perfect process, but what I've been taught is, like, yeah, we fall short. But the first time you do something is a mistake. The second time you do it is a choice. And I cannot use falling short as a prefabricated excuse to be a scumbag. You know, you identify the problem and then you put a solution in motion. And if I don't deal with something in my conscience, I'll deal with it in my consequences. And that's tough, man. Like, I don't want consequences. I don't want to pay for the bad mistakes I've made. And what I've learned through this and through the guidance of sponsorship is, like, if I verbalize my absolutely crazy ideas before I follow through with them, consequences aren't that bad. Usually an ear beating from my sponsor and, like, asking me where I'm at in my step work. If I call him after I put this plan in motion, and then the consequences are a lot worse. And, you know, I just can't talk enough about the program, and I wanted people to hand me clean time. And I understand now that how much I would have been robbed of if somebody would have just granted me a year clean, 2 years clean, 5 years clean. Like, this process is so amazing from the beginning. Like, thinking about walking into that basement in Mount Washington, like, what did I get myself into to where I'm at today? I don't gauge myself by material things, but I do, like, I live on my, I make some bad choices. I moved out of a 3-quarter house into a house with 2 other guys in a really bad section of Pittsburgh. Both of them went to jail. Both of them got high. I stayed clean through it. I moved in, actually, at this retreat last year. I talked to my sponsor and some of my sponsee brothers about it, and they're like, get your own place. And I made all these excuses, like, oh, I don't have the money, I don't have this, I don't have that. And I remember specifically the next time I saw one of my sponsee brothers, Hank, he said, so you don't have the money to get your own place? And I said, no. He said, well, you got a $350 pair of jeans on. And, you know, we kind of laughed about it. And then after the meeting, he came back and he said, seriously, it's time to grow up. Like, it's time to get responsible. Those pants aren't going to keep you clean. Clothes aren't going to keep you clean. A car isn't going to keep you clean. Like, understand where you're at. And that's important to me. Honesty, from, even if I'm not ready to receive it, honesty from my support group when they tell me when I'm screwing up. With the people that I'm close to, catching people in their first 30 days and making them feel at home here is very important, but also focusing on the people in their last 30 days, the ones that are on their way out the door and you can see it. Because that was me before. People knew I was heading towards a disaster and heading towards a relapse, and they told me, and I wasn't ready to hear it, but some of those things those people said to me, one particular person here told me one time, the sin is in falling, it's in falling and failing to get back up. Through the amazing program of Narcotics Anonymous, I've been able to return key tags to people, and that's really important to me. Like, people that have given me things that are very special to them, and I'm able to, like, put the work in and return those. Like, that's big for me. That's what this is about, because at its rawest form, when I don't know who I am, let alone anybody else knows who I am, somebody believed in me, because I didn't believe in myself. And I used for a long time against my own will. I wanted to stop. I didn't know how. And through this program, I was given I can't even say a second chance. It's probably a 50-second chance on life. And I honestly, I can't really express my gratitude. They say gratitude's an action word, and I understand that, and that's why I do things like I continue to show up. I also have an H&I commitment. It's one of the best things I've ever done in my life. It's at a particular facility that I didn't necessarily relate to that well. Again, I'm making plans, and I go in there, and it's a truly humbling experience. But I've been told things like, stay in the middle so you don't fall off the edge. You know, get involved, stay involved, and help people. And by helping people, I get outside of myself. The self-centeredness kind of starts to creep away, and I start to get better without even realizing it. It's pretty amazing. So if you're new, stick around. We need you here. The biggest thing for me is sponsorship, because it's something I never did before. Work steps. You got to work steps. It's all about change. I was told very early on at my first treatment facility, if you don't change the addict that comes into the program, you will use again. I'm like, man, you don't know me, whatever. And it rings true, because the times that I'm not willing to change, or like in that experiment where I change and go right back to the way I was, I get high. When I don't take the suggestions, like Haley talked about, what I feel today is simple suggestions, but at the time it's catastrophic to, like, don't use the phone for the first 7 days in rehab. I'm like, what do you mean I can't use the phone? Like, I've been clean for 28 hours. I need to tell my family I'm sorry. You know, by taking a little bit of guidance and following some people that have been around a little longer than me, life has gotten better. And they talk about, you know, the message. And I'll close with that. But, the message is that any addict can stop using, lose the desire to use, and find a new way of life. My name's Scott. I'm an addict. I'm going to keep coming back.